We would like to send out a special thanks to HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit, for sponsoring this episode. Go to HelloFresh.com/50WentCold and use code 50WentCold for 50% off plus free shipping. Enjoy the episode.
December 6, 1991, Austin, Texas. After responding to a fire at a local yogurt shop, authorities discover the bodies of four victims who have all been shot in the head. 17-year-old employees Eliza Thomas and Jennifer Harbison, Jennifer's 15-year-old sister Sarah Harbison, and Sarah's 13-year-old friend Amy Ayers. Nearly 8 years later, investigators arrest four suspects for the murders, and while charges against two of them are eventually dropped, the other two, Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott, confess to the crime, so they wind up being convicted at trial. However, both men's convictions are overturned due to civil rights violations, and forensics testing reveals the presence of DNA on the victims, which does not match any of the alleged perpetrators. In 2009, the charges against the two defendants are dismissed and they are released from prison, so there are no conclusive answers about who actually committed the Austin Yogurt Shop murders. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be covering a very infamous case and releasing what will be the first part of an extensive two-part series, the 1991 murders of Eliza Thomas, Jennifer Harbison, Sarah Harbison, and Amy Ayers, a.k.a. the Austin Yogurt Shop Murders. And that voice you just heard narrating our intro was Melissa Lovell, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Melissa. This is a contest which we've been carrying on for 6 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, as you probably know, this coming weekend I'm going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival in Austin, Texas, and whenever I attend one of these podcasting events, I always make it a tradition to cover a cold case from the host city that same week. Well, I do not believe there is a more infamous case from this particular city than the Austin Yogurt Shop murders, and since it also happens to be one of my most highly requested cases which I have yet to cover, I thought now would be a good time to tackle it. However, since it is such a complicated story that has had so many surprising developments these past 3 decades, I'm going to turn it into a two-part episode, and our second part will be released next Wednesday, August the 30th. This is an incredibly horrific quadruple murder which took place at a shop that was part of the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt chain. Best friends Jennifer Harbison and Eliza Thomas were working the closing shift there together, but would be joined at the shop by Jennifer's younger sister, Sarah Harbison, as well as Sarah's best friend, Amy Ayers. However, right around the time the shop was scheduled to close, all four of these girls would be murdered. The victims were forced to strip, bound and gagged with their own clothing, and at least some of them were sexually assaulted before they were each shot in the head, and the responsible party started a fire which pretty much burned their bodies beyond recognition. Years later, a total of 4 suspects, Robert Springsteen, Michael Scott, Maurice Pierce, and Forrest Wellburn, were arrested for their roles in the murders, but this would definitely not be the end of the story, as the entire case against them was based around questionable confessions from Springfield and Scott, who would recant their stories and claim they were coerced by the police. Since Pierce and Wellborn did not confess, there was not enough evidence to bring either of them to trial, but Springfield and Scott did go to trial, and their confessions would be enough to convince their respective juries to find them guilty. The two men's convictions would eventually be overturned, and a new round of forensic testing would turn up DNA evidence which did not match any of the 4 suspects, and since this revelation made it difficult to bring Springfield or Scott to trial again, the state elected to drop the murder charges against them and allow them to walk free. Now, neither of them has officially been exonerated per se, as some investigators believe that they still committed the murders, and the DNA actually belongs to an unidentified accomplice who was there with them. But the majority consensus seems to be that these four men were railroaded and had nothing to do with the crime, and that at least two other individuals are the real killers. Like I said, there's a lot to discuss here, so on this particular episode, I'll share all the facts of the case and then provide my theories and analysis on part two next week. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now begin part one of our series about the Austin Yogurt Shop murders. Our story begins in Austin, Texas in 1991, and the crime takes place at a soft-serve frozen yogurt shop, which is part of the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt chain, and located at the Hillside Center Strip Mall on West Anderson Lane. At 11:47 p.m. on Friday, December the 6th, a patrolman from the Austin Police Department noticed a fire at this yogurt shop and called for assistance over the radio. When firefighters arrived at the scene, they noticed that the shop's lights were off, the closed sign was facing outward, and the front door was locked, but oddly, a key was still in the lock on the inside. After the firefighters used a crowbar to bust open the door and entered the shop, they noticed that the fire was burning in a small area near the back door. They were able to extinguish the flames quickly, but after the smoke cleared, they were horrified to discover that the severely burned nude bodies of four young female victims were on the floor. It would turn out that two of the victims were 17-year-old Eliza Thomas and 17-year-old Jennifer Harbison, a pair of best friends who were employees at the shop and had been working the closing shift that night. The other two victims were Jennifer's 15-year-old sister, Sarah Harbison, and Sarah's 13-year-old best friend, Amy Ayers. Jennifer and Sarah's parents, Mike and Barbara Harbison, had gotten divorced when both girls were young, and the two girls were currently living in Austin with their mother and stepfather. Jennifer had recently been given a new truck by her father and took the job at the yogurt shop in order to help make the loan payments. Eliza's parents, James and Maria Thomas, had also gotten divorced when she was young, but her father and mother both remained in Austin with Eliza and her younger sister, Sonora, splitting time between them. As for Amy, she lived in Austin with her parents, Bob and Pam Ayers, and had an older brother named Sean. Jennifer, Sarah, and Eliza were all students at Lanier High School, and while Amy attended Burnett Middle School, all four girls were members of the Future Farmers of America organization. Before she started her shift that evening, Jennifer had dropped Sarah and Amy off at the nearby North Cross Mall to spend a couple of hours hanging out, but when the mall closed at 9 p.m., Jennifer picked the two girls up and brought them back to the yogurt shop. Amy was planning to spend the night having a sleepover at Sarah's residence, so their plan was to hang out at the shop and help Jennifer prepare for closing at 11 o'clock. Jennifer would then drive Sarah and Amy back to her place, but before they got a chance to leave, someone had entered the shop and murdered everyone inside before they started a fire in what was a likely attempt to destroy evidence. The bodies of Eliza, Jennifer, and Sarah were stacked on top of each other, and they'd all been shot in the back of the head, execution style, with a .22 caliber weapon. Amy's body was found a few feet away from them, and while she had also been shot in the back of the head with a .22 caliber weapon, it turned out she also had a second gunshot wound in her head from a .380 automatic Colt pistol, possibly because the bullet from the first shot missed her brain. Amy also had a cloth ligature around her neck to suggest that someone had attempted to strangle her. The bodies of Eliza, Jennifer, and Sarah were burned beyond recognition, and they had to be positively identified through their dental records. But since Amy was a few feet away from them, she was not as badly charred and had burns on about 25 to 30% of her body. It's been theorized that Amy may have still been alive when the firefighters first arrived at the scene and had made an attempt to crawl away from the rest of the victims, but passed away before the fire was put out. Prior to their deaths, all four victims had their clothing removed, likely after they were ordered to undress by the killer or killers. While some of their articles of clothing were found neatly stacked on the floor near their bodies, other articles had been used to bind and gag the victims. At least some of the girls had been raped, but since the Travis County District Attorney would petition for the autopsy results to be sealed, a lot of specific details about the crime were not released publicly for years. An ice scoop was also found on the floor between Sarah's thighs, though there has always been debate about whether this item was used to sexually assault her or if it simply fell off a shelf, possibly due to the spray from the fire hoses, and just happened to wind up there. The shop's back door was discovered to be broken, and since the keys to the front door were found in the lock, the responsible parties likely used the rear door to exit the establishment after committing the crime. The cash register was empty, and the till was found on the storage room floor near Amy's body, with coins scattered around her face. An audit would later reveal that $540 was missing from the register, which seemed to point to robbery being a potential motive for the crime, but oddly, an open bank bag containing additional money was left behind under the register. The register's log showed that someone had used the no sale button to open it at 11:03 p.m., 3 minutes after closing time, and an unopened Coke can and an empty styrofoam cup were also found next to the register. This led to speculation that the killer may have gone up to the counter and ordered a Coke before pulling out a gun and forcing Jennifer or Eliza to empty the register. Indeed, in the months prior to this crime, a number of robberies had taken place at other businesses at the Hillside Center Strip Mall located near the yogurt shop, leading to speculation that there might be some sort of connection. Melvin Stahl, the arson investigator for the Austin Fire Department, believed the fire had originally been started on some steel shelves located in a corner alongside the south wall of the storage room at the back of the yogurt shop. The shelves contained a lot of combustible items, like styrofoam cups, which could have caused the fire to spread, and Stahl estimated that it was started at approximately 11:42 p.m., 5 minutes before the radio call, which summoned them to the scene. Unfortunately, since the firefighters arrived before the police did and used water to extinguish the flames, potential evidence may have been lost or compromised. As the years went on, key pieces of evidence from the shop would go missing, such as the aforementioned steel shelves and a ladder which had its aluminum alloy melted by the fire. The day after the crime took place, the broken lock on the rear door was replaced, but it would also later go missing. The murders devastated the entire community, particularly Mike and Barbara Harbison, since Jennifer and Sarah were their only children, and in the ensuing years, all of the victims' families would move out of the Austin area. A funeral was held for all four girls at St. Louis Catholic Church and was attended by over 1,000 people. Jennifer, Sarah, and Amy were all buried together in Capitol Memorial Gardens, while Eliza was buried separately at Austin Memorial Park Cemetery. A check into the backgrounds of all four girls showed that none of them had any known enemies who would have had a motive to kill them in such a brutal fashion, so the crime seemed completely perplexing. On the night of the murders, Eliza's mother, Maria, had stopped by the yogurt shop at around 9:30 p.m. in order to check on her daughter and Jennifer, and said she did not notice anything unusual at that time. Eliza's father, James, also stopped by the shop a short time later and reported the same thing. Investigators would interview a number of customers who had frequented the yogurt shop in the hours prior to the murders in an attempt to build a timeline. Sometime between 8:15 and 8:30 p.m. that night, a woman named Lucella Jones had stopped by the shop to pick up some frozen yogurt and recalled that the only customers there at that time were a pair of teenage boys with long, unkempt hair who seemed to be paying a lot of attention to a bag or a sack resting in the middle of their table. Sometime between 9:30 and 10, while Maria Thomas was still there, a customer named Daryl Croft entered the shop and took note of what he described as a fidgety young man who appeared to be in his 20s and was wearing a green, military-style jacket. Croft was a former military policeman who ran a security firm, and when the man noticed his company car parked outside with lights on top, he asked Croft if he was a cop. The young man then ordered a Sprite and went to the back of the store, presumably to use the washroom. Since Croft said he had a weird feeling about this guy, he decided to wait around the shop for a few minutes after ordering his yogurt, but wound up leaving before the young man emerged from the back. The last known customers to frequent the shop that night was a couple named Tim Stryker and Margaret Sheehan, who bought some yogurt at 10:42 p.m., which was the last recorded purchase on the register. The couple told police that they left about 5 minutes later, but noticed that two young men were sitting at the table which was closest to the register. They were both described as being in their late 20s, early 30s, with one of them being around 5'6" and having a skinny frame and lighter brown or dirty blonde hair. The other man apparently had darker hair and appeared to be bigger and more muscular. Both men were wearing larger coats, with one of them being black and the other resembling a green army fatigue-style jacket. It was standard practice for the shop's employees to lock the front door 10 minutes before closing time, and since the key was found in the lock when the firemen arrived, it seemed likely that Jennifer or Eliza had locked the door and turned the close sign outward right after Stryker and Sheehan exited. The couple had also recalled seeing the girls stacking the chairs on top of the tables and filling the napkin dispensers, but the table where these two men sat was the only one with the chairs still on the floor, and the napkin dispenser was also empty. No one could confirm having seen either of these guys exit the shop, and even though investigators were able to account for and interview most of the customers who frequented the shop that night, these men did not come forward, even after the case generated massive publicity, and they've never been identified. Well, on December the 14th, 8 days after the murders, investigators got their first major person of interest when 16-year-old Maurice Pierce was arrested at the North Cross Mall and charged with unlawful possession of a weapon. Another kid at the mall had noticed a gun sticking out of Maurice's waistband and notified police, and it turned out Maurice was carrying a loaded .22 caliber pistol and 16 extra rounds. Given that a .22 caliber weapon was used in the yogurt shop murders, and the mall was located only about a half mile away from the shop, this piqued the Austin PD's interest, and they wanted to question Maurice about his potential involvement in the crime. At the time Maurice was arrested, he was accompanied by a 15-year-old friend of his named Forrest Wellborn, and when interviewed by one of the detectives, Senior Sergeant Hector Polanco, Maurice claimed that Forrest lent him the gun, and it had likely been used in the yogurt shop murders. Along with Forrest, Maurice implicated two other friends of his, 17-year-old Robert Burns Springsteen IV and 17-year-old Michael Scott, as being involved in the crime. Rob's parents were divorced, and he had moved from West Virginia to Austin a few months earlier. He was currently residing in a condo which was owned by the girlfriend of his father, Robert Springsteen III, and Michael Scott was his roommate. Interestingly enough, on the morning of December the 6th, the same date as the murders, Robert III had called the police to report his son missing. He claimed that he had not seen Rob or Mike since the evening of December the 4th, though as far as anyone could tell, no follow-up was ever done on this report. According to Maurice, his three friends had committed the murders while he simply functioned as the getaway driver, and later that weekend, they proceeded to steal a Nissan Pathfinder from a car dealership in order to leave Austin and travel to San Antonio. Well, the lead investigator on the case was a veteran police sergeant named John Jones, and he was very skeptical of Maurice's story. While Rob, Mike, and Forrest were questioned about their potential roles in the crime, they all denied any knowledge or involvement. In fact, at one point, police had Maurice wear a wire for a secretly recorded conversation with Forrest, but while Maurice tried to press him into sharing incriminating details about the yogurt shop murders, Jones got the impression that Forrest clearly had no idea what Maurice was talking about. Ballistic tests were also performed on Maurice's .22 caliber pistol to compare it to the bullets from the murder scene, but the results were inconclusive. Maurice did not share any exclusive details to indicate he had inside knowledge of the crime, and a search of his home turned up no evidence, so Jones felt that Maurice made up the entire story and may have been feeding the police false information in hopes it would prevent him from getting charged with carrying a concealed weapon. While the four young men were not completely ruled out as suspects, Jones was inclined to believe that none of them were involved. However, there were some red flags involving Hector Polanco, the first detective who had spoken to Maurice following his arrest. During the first few months of the investigation, Polanco managed to coerce confessions from two suspects which turned out to be bogus. One of them was a drug dealer slash drag queen named Sean Buddha Smith, who claimed that he was present at the murder scene with three other accomplices who targeted Eliza because she had supposedly ripped off $200 worth of weed from them. Well, when Smith shared this story while hooked up to a polygraph, he wound up flunking, and he soon recanted his confession, claiming that he had only admitted to the crime because Polanco told him they had a videotape of him at the yogurt shop. The other suspect who falsely confessed to Polanco was Alex Briones, who had recently been arrested for the murder of an elderly woman in the town of Windcrest, and claimed he committed the yogurt shop murders alongside an accomplice and that it was a robbery gone wrong. But Briones' story fell apart when he was asked to pick out his accomplice from a photo lineup, and he wound up picking out a suspect who was in prison when the murders took place. Polanco was soon taken off the yogurt shop murders investigation, as it turned out he had a long history of eliciting questionable confessions from suspects, including one case which I'm going to discuss in more detail on our next episode. The breaking point was when Polanco obtained a false signed confession from a suspect named John Salazar in the murder of a Travis County Sheriff's deputy named William Redman, as the real killers wound up confessing to other investigators at pretty much the exact same time. If that wasn't enough, it turned out that Salazar was already in police custody for another crime when Redman's murder took place. In September of 1992, Polanco was fired from the Austin Police Department on the grounds of suspicion of perjury, misuse of authority, and witness tampering, though he later wound up getting his job back through an arbitration process after he sued the city for racism. Well, believe it or not, shortly after Polanco was fired, there would be another series of questionable confessions to the yogurt shop murders. During the early stages of the investigation, a composite sketch was circulated for an unidentified young Hispanic-looking man with long hair, as multiple eyewitnesses had reported seeing him inside a white car outside the yogurt shop on the night of the murders. Well, it turned out that on November the 17th, 1991, 3 weeks before the murders took place, three Hispanic men had abducted a young woman outside an Austin nightclub and proceeded to rape her before dropping her off in San Antonio. The Austin PD's Sex Crimes Unit released composite sketches of the three suspects, and investigators soon noticed that one of them bore a striking resemblance to the unidentified man seen sitting outside the yogurt shop in the white car. The men responsible for the abduction and rape were eventually identified as Alberto Jimenez Cortez, Porfiria Villa Saavedra, and Ricardo Hernandez, a group of Mexican nationals who were all members of a motorcycle gang called the Mierdas Punks. The three men were believed to have crossed the border into Mexico shortly after the attack, and Cortez was the one who appeared to resemble the sketch of the yogurt shop suspect. While Cortez and Saavedra were finally tracked down and arrested in Mexico in October of 1992, not just for the rape, but for other crimes such as drug trafficking and gun smuggling. While Mexico's deputy attorney general would not allow the two men to be extradited to the United States, they could still stand trial for these crimes in Mexico City. But while they were being held in custody by the Mexican authorities, they both supposedly confessed to the yogurt shop murders and even mentioned that the victims were raped, a piece of information that the Austin PD had not released publicly by that point. However, John Jones was skeptical of their confessions, as Cortez and Saavedra shared a number of incorrect details, such as the caliber of guns that were used, and Saavedra had even said that the girls were cut up and mutilated. When Jones re-interviewed these two men, they recanted their confessions and claimed they had been coerced after they were tortured. Cortez and Saavedra did stand trial and were convicted of their other crimes, though, as far as anyone can tell, their other accomplice, Ricardo Hernandez, was never found. Regardless, none of these men were ever charged with the yogurt shop murders, and it's suspected that the Mexican authorities coerced their confessions in order to take credit for solving the case. According to Jones, over 50 people falsely confessed to the crime over the course of the investigation, and would usually only provide information that was either public knowledge or details which turned out to be false. This made Jones decide that he was not going to accept any confessions unless they were backed up by corroborating evidence. After the murders took place, the I Can't Believe It's yogurt shop on West Anderson Lane would never reopen for business, and the location was eventually turned into a nail salon. A billboard was erected in Austin asking people to come forward if they had information, and it featured a photograph of the four victims accompanied by these words, quote, "Who killed these girls?" In the months prior to the crime, Texas Governor Ann Richards had actually stopped by the yogurt shop and was given a free yogurt by Jennifer. So in tribute, Richard declared June 5th, 1992, to be We Will Not Forget Day, and held a memorial walk in which 1,200 people traveled across the Congress Avenue Bridge and walked to the Texas State Capitol building. The victims' families would file a lawsuit against the yogurt shop's parent company, Bryce Foods, as well as Morrison Properties, who owned the Hillside Center strip mall. The families alleged that the defendants had failed to install adequate security measures at the yogurt shop to protect their employees, even though a series of robberies had taken place at the strip mall in the months prior to the murders. In January of 1994, the two sides reached a $12 million settlement, and the families would use the money to start a nonprofit organization about crime prevention and workplace safety called We Will Not Forget, SAJE, which of course were the first initials for each of the four girls. Later that same year, Sergeant John Jones was taken off the yogurt shop case and transferred to the Austin PD's Assault Division, as the investigation seemed to have hit a brick wall. However, in August of 1999, a new task force was formed in order to relaunch the investigation, and would be led by homicide detective Paul Johnson. Even though Jones had always been skeptical of the involvement of Maurice Pierce, Robert Springsteen, Michael Scott, and Forrest Wellborn, the task force wanted to take a fresh look at them as potential suspects. By this point, all four men were in their mid-20s, and while each of them had dropped out of high school and had a reputation for being juvenile delinquents, they all seemed to be at a decent place in their lives. Maurice had relocated to Louisville and gotten married, and now had a 7-year-old daughter, and was working a job at a warehouse. Rob had gone back to Charleston, West Virginia, and was now married and working two jobs. Mike was still living in the Austin area and working as a mechanic, and had recently gotten married and now had a stepdaughter. Forrest relocated to Lockhart and seemed to be doing well as a mechanic, as he had recently opened his own auto repair shop, and he had one daughter with a girlfriend he had not yet married. Even though these men had occasional brushes with the law, including a drunk driving arrest for Maurice, a misdemeanor marijuana arrest for Mike, and a driving with a suspended license arrest for Forrest, none of them had any known history of violence. Over the years, investigators from the Austin PD had periodically checked in with all these men and spoken to them over the phone, but never obtained any useful information. Regardless, the Yogurt Shop Task Force felt they should all be re-interviewed. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to our sponsor, HelloFresh. Summer is finally coming to an end, and we're about to enter the fall season, so you'll want to find a way to banish the end of summer blues. This is a time when you're going to have many places to be, and, well, standing in the checkout line is not one of them. So that's why you should leave the meal planning and the grocery shopping to HelloFresh. With pre-portioned ingredients and easy step-by-step recipes delivered to your door, you'll save so much time and cut out the hassle. Go to HelloFresh.com/50WentCold and use code 50WentCold for 50% off plus free shipping. Anyway, I'm sure many of you listeners are parents and have been quite busy with back-to-school shopping and planning. Things are only going to get busier, and there are some nights when you might be tempted to order takeout to save time, but HelloFresh is actually 25% cheaper as well as less expensive than grocery shopping, and when you order HelloFresh, all you have to do is select your recipes and receive fresh, pre-portioned ingredients to help you get cooking quickly and prepare a wholesome, homemade meal. The key to dinnertime success is variety, and HelloFresh keeps your taste buds on your toes with 40 chef-crafted recipes to select from every week. The options include everything from family-friendly to fit and wholesome, and you'll always find new and exciting recipes to try and love. I recently had myself a delicious meal of meatballs and retro chili sauce. It reminds you of the meatballs your grandmother used to make, but instead of sauce from a jar, it's made from scratch. The meatballs consist of golden beef and pork, and you also get a nice side of garlic buttered rice. And what's particularly great is that it can be prepared easily in only 30 minutes. So once again, go to HelloFresh.com/50WentCold and use code 50WentCold for 50% off plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/50WentCold and the promo code is 50WentCold. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. On September the 9th, Mike was brought into the police station for questioning by Detectives Ron Lara, John Hardesty, and Robert Merrill, and all of their interrogation sessions would be videotaped. Mike acknowledged that he had a bad memory and may have forgotten events which took place nearly 8 years later, but the two detectives started planting the seeds in his head that he may have been involved in the yogurt shop murders. At one point, 10 hours into the interrogation, Mike was given a cell phone to call his wife and told her, quote, "I know more about this case than I thought I knew." Mike was allowed to return home and spend the night with his wife, but returned for more questioning the following day. After being interrogated for a total of 18 hours over the course of 2 days, Mike finally confessed that he had participated in the murders and personally shot Amy and started the fire. Mike would be asked to sign a 14-page written statement admitting his participation in the crime, though some of the details in the statement were different from what Mike had originally shared during his videotaped confession. Regardless, the Yogurt Shop Task Force now wanted to move in on Robert Springsteen, so Detectives Lara and Merrill traveled to West Virginia to interview him. Rob was brought in for questioning after having worked multiple shifts at his two jobs, so he had gotten virtually no sleep, and after being interrogated for a total of over 20 hours over the next few days, Rob eventually made his own confession to the crime. While Mike had only admitted to participating in the murder of the girls, Rob confessed that he had sexually assaulted Amy, as after constantly being pressed about this by the detectives throughout the interrogation, he finally snapped and yelled out, quote, "Okay, I put my dick in her pussy and I raped her." Even though Mike and Rob had shared differing details about the crime during their respective confessions, investigators were able to use the information they learned to construct a scenario about what they believe happened. According to the two men, the crime had been a robbery gone wrong, and Maurice Pierce had been the mastermind behind the whole thing. The group had been casing the yogurt shop since the afternoon, and when evening hit, Maurice entered the shop and purchased a yogurt in order to keep Jennifer and Eliza distracted, while Mike and Rob snuck into the back area and unlocked the rear door. They proceeded to use a folded pack of cigarettes to prop the door open, which would allow them to enter the shop after closing time. While Forrest did not directly participate in the murders, he sat outside in the group's getaway car in order to function as a lookout. When Maurice, Mike, and Rob entered the establishment after 11 p.m., they were thrown off by the fact that in addition to the two employees, Sarah and Amy also happened to be there. After the register was opened, Maurice became angry because there wasn't as much cash in there as he was expecting, so he demanded to know where the rest of the money was being kept. The girls were forced to take off their clothes and tied up at gunpoint, but when Eliza and Jennifer maintained that there was no additional money, Maurice shot them both in the back of the head. Maurice then ordered Rob to rape Amy, which he did, and while Mike attempted to rape Sarah, he could not achieve an erection. Maurice threatened Mike and told him to shoot the other two girls in the head or he would be next, so Mike complied. However, since Amy did not die right away, Mike shot her in the head twice with both a .22 caliber gun and a .380 pistol. In spite of this, Amy still attempted to crawl away, so Maurice finished her off by strangling her with a ligature. While this was going on, Mike stacked the other three girls' bodies on top of each other, covered them with combustible materials like paper cups and napkins, and then proceeded to douse them with lighter fluid in order to set the bodies on fire. When the three suspects fled the shop, they discovered that Forrest was no longer in the getaway car, but after they climbed into the vehicle and drove off, they came across Forrest walking down the street a few blocks away and picked him up. Shortly thereafter, they went to a bridge and tossed the .380 pistol into Lake Austin. On October the 6th, the Austin Police Department held a press conference to announce that Robert Springsteen, Michael Scott, Maurice Pierce, and Forrest Wellborn had all been arrested for their alleged roles in the yogurt shop murders. However, in spite of Rob and Mike's confessions, Maurice and Forrest maintained their innocence, and even after being extensively interrogated, the two men would not confess to their involvement in the crime. In fact, Rob and Mike would soon recant their own confessions, maintaining that they had been coerced, and since their interrogation sessions dragged on for so long, they both eventually reached the point in which they told investigators what they wanted to hear. Indeed, since both men were high school dropouts who had undergone special education classes, they were particularly susceptible to such tactics. At one point during Rob's interrogation, Detective Robert Merrill pulled out the same .22 caliber pistol which had been confiscated from Maurice years earlier and pointed it at the back of Rob's head. In fact, controversy erupted when a photocopied image of Merrill holding the gun to Rob's head, which had been taken from the original videotape, was circulated on the internet. The image had been presented at a pretrial hearing for the suspects and only increased rumors that the police had frightened them into making false confessions. While Rob and Mike did share a number of accurate details about the crime, there was some question about whether this information had been fed to them by investigators. Even though all four suspects had been questioned about the crime back in 1991, no record was ever kept of their original interrogation sessions, so it was impossible to know if detectives could have supplied them with any information which they repeated when they were questioned again nearly 8 years later. And given what a major story the yogurt shop murders were in Austin, details about the crime had leaked out and spread throughout the city for years, so the suspects easily could have heard about them this way. In addition, Mike did share some details during his confession which turned out to be inaccurate. For instance, he claimed that he had gone inside the yogurt shop's office to search around, but when police arrived at the scene, they discovered that the office was locked. They had to find a key to open the door, and nothing in the office appeared to be disturbed. No physical evidence linked any of the four suspects to the crime, so the case against them would hinge almost entirely on Rob and Mike's confessions. Well, even though the state secured capital murder indictments against Rob, Mike, and Maurice, they were unable to do so against Forrest, even though the case against him was submitted to two separate grand juries. As a result, Forrest was released on bail, while the other three defendants remained in Travis County Jail. Of course, the big issue was that neither of the confessions actually placed Forrest at the murder scene, as Rob and Mike both said that he waited in the car as a lookout and walked away before they left the shop, so it could not be proven if Forrest was even aware that violence was going to take place. At one point, Forrest was reportedly approached by prosecutors with an offer to testify against his three co-defendants in exchange for immunity, but he declined their offer and continued to maintain that he was not involved in the crime. In June of 2000, the murder charges against him were dropped, but even though Forrest was now a free man again, the damage to his reputation had already been done as his auto repair shop went under and he found himself unable to secure employment. While all the defendants maintained their innocence, Maurice's defense attorney publicly expressed his belief that Rob and Mike were responsible for the murders, but had falsely implicated Maurice. A decision was made to give each of them separate trials, though the state would continue to run into obstacles building a solid case against them. As you might recall, on the night of the murders, a number of customers, including LaCella Jones, Daryl Croft, Tim Stryker, and Margaret Sheehan, reported seeing suspicious-looking young men in the shop whom they believed were acting strangely, but none of them were able to positively identify these men as any of the defendants. In fact, Stryker and Sheehan would not be called upon to testify at any of the trials, as their accounts seemed to contradict the confessions. The couple claimed to have seen two men sitting at a table inside the shop at closing time, but Rob and Mike had confessed that they entered through the back door after the shop was closed. While it was possible that these two men were innocent bystanders who left before the murders took place, the fact that they were never identified or tracked down created some uncertainty about the state's case. Now, as you might recall, when Maurice was originally arrested for carrying a .22 caliber pistol back in December of 1991, ballistics tests were performed to compare the gun to the bullets from the murder scene, but the results were inconclusive. Well, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms performed more advanced ballistics testings, but in May of 2000, they issued a report in which the results conclusively showed that Maurice's gun did not match the bullets. However, it would soon come out that in January of 1999, nearly 9 months before the suspects were arrested, the Austin PD had already performed their own ballistics tests on the gun. Once again, the results showed that the gun did not match the bullets, but the Yogurt Shop Task Force failed to include this information in any reports when they filed charges against the defendants, and this evidence was never presented to the grand jury when the indictments were handed down. When questioned about this, Detective Paul Johnson claimed that this was an unintentional oversight and that he simply forgot to mention the ballistics tests. But Johnson seemed to contradict this claim when he testified during the grand jury proceedings, as he had originally said that the bullets were too damaged to compare them to the .22. Regardless, the trials against the three defendants would still move forward, and a calculated decision was made to only charge them with Amy Ayers' murder. This meant that if any of the defendants were acquitted, the door was still open for the state to charge them and take them to trial again for the murders of any of the other three girls. Rob's trial finally began in May of 2001, and he would face the death penalty if found guilty. At one point, Rob's defense team were offered a plea deal in which the death penalty would be taken off the table, and he'd receive a sentence of no more than 14 years in prison if he agreed to testify against his co-conspirators, but Rob refused to take the deal. To everyone's surprise, Rob took the stand to testify on his own behalf and maintained his confession was false. He claimed that he had only got a handful of hours worth of sleep in the days prior to his interrogation and only admitted to the murders because he was exhausted. While Mike himself refused to testify as a witness at Rob's trial, parts of his written confession he had signed were presented as evidence, as the prosecution claimed that it corroborated Rob's own confession. One of the most controversial elements of the confessions was the defendants' claims that they had used an accelerant to set the victims' bodies on fire. Marvin Stahl of the Austin Fire Department had concluded that the fire originated from some metal shelves located near the back of the shop, which were filled with combustible materials such as styrofoam cups. But prior to the trial, investigators had consulted with Marshall Littleton, a former Austin police officer who was now working for the ATF as an explosives and fire investigator. Littleton believed that the fire had originated from the center of the room and concurred with Michael Scott's story that he had placed flammable items on top of the victims' bodies and used an accelerant like lighter fluid to start the fire. When Stahl testified at the trial, he confirmed that after meeting with Littleton and reviewing his findings and re-examining the original crime scene photos, he had changed his original ruling and now believed that an accelerant was used to start the fire, which matched the confessions. While the defense attempted to introduce evidence which pointed towards an alternate suspect. On December the 29th, 1991, just over 3 weeks after the yogurt shop murders took place, Austin experienced another horrific crime when 28-year-old Colleen Reed was violently abducted from a car wash located not too far from the yogurt shop before she was raped, tortured, and murdered. 4 months later, the perpetrators were identified as Kenneth Allen McDuff and Alva Hank Worley. While Worley admitted to participating in Colleen's abduction and sexually assaulting her, he said that McDuff was the one who actually killed her before burying her body. McDuff had since left Texas, but following Worley's confession, McDuff was soon arrested at a homeless shelter in Kansas City, Missouri. McDuff had previously been sentenced to death for murdering three teenagers back in 1966, but his sentence was commuted to life imprisonment, and he actually wound up being paroled in 1989 due to a prison overcrowding epidemic in Texas at that time. Unfortunately, McDuff went on to commit more murders, and while he's officially confirmed to have killed at least 9 victims, the authorities have always suspected that his actual victim count may be higher and as much as 14. McDuff received 2 separate death sentences for the murder of Colleen Reed and the 1992 murder of a 22-year-old convenience store clerk named Melissa Northrup. He would confess to additional murders while on death row and even led the authorities to some of his victims' bodies, including Colleen Reed, before he was executed on November the 17th, 1998. While at the time of the yogurt shop murders, McDuff was living in Waco, Texas, but would often go to Austin to score drugs. While Robert Springsteen's trial was taking place, the Austin TV station, KVUE News, reported that some anonymous sources had claimed that McDuff confessed to the yogurt shop murders on the day he was executed, but investigators did not find him to be credible, as he apparently got key details wrong, such as saying that there were 5 victims instead of 4. Well, a spokesperson for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice responded to this report by confirming that McDuff was extensively questioned prior to his execution, but the authorities were satisfied that he did not have information about additional crimes, and to his knowledge, McDuff never mentioned the yogurt shop murders. Rob's defense team was also hoping to present evidence that when McDuff was originally arrested, An eyewitness had phoned in a tip placing McDuff at Austin's North Cross Mall on December the 6th, 1991, and of course, the mall was less than half a mile away from the yogurt shop. But in the end, the trial judge believed that all the evidence implicating McDuff was nothing more than hearsay and would not allow the defense to use it or even say McDuff's name in front of the jury. And as far as I can tell, other than KVUE so-called anonymous sources, no one has ever officially confirmed that McDuff confessed to the crime prior to his execution. Well, Rob's trial lasted 3 weeks, but on May the 30th, after deliberating for a total of 13 hours, the jury found him guilty of Amy Ayers' murder, and he would be sentenced to death via lethal injection. Michael Scott's trial would begin over 1 year later in August of 2002. Much like the previous trial, the case against Mike was based largely on his own confession, and even though Rob refused to testify as a witness, his confession could be introduced as evidence. This time around, the defense called the former yogurt shop manager Reese Price as a witness, and she would testify during voir dire outside the presence of the jury while the trial judge evaluated whether or not her testimony could be included as evidence. Reese claimed that both she and Jennifer had received harassing phone calls prior to the murders from someone who threatened to kill them and cut them up. In fact, the police had placed a trace on Jennifer's phone line in case the threats continued, but no more calls like that came in. Reese also testified that a burglary had taken place at her own apartment nearly 1 year before the murders, but the perpetrator never actually stole anything, and instead took a couple of pairs of underwear out of her drawer, laid them out on her bed, and placed a kitchen knife on top of them. Another odd detail that Reese shared was that the employees at the yogurt shop sometimes heard odd noises in the crawl space which connected the building to an adjacent party shop in the strip mall, and there was even one closing shift in which Reese discovered shoe prints on the toilet seat in the men's washroom, and the ceiling tile above it was out of place. The defense was attempting to plant the seeds that someone else besides Mike might have been responsible for the murders, and since Reese bore a bit of a resemblance to Jennifer, they explored the possibility that the crime might have been a case of mistaken identity. But in the end, the judge did not believe that Reese's testimony was relevant to the case and would not allow it to be heard as evidence by the jury. The case eventually went to the jury, and on September the 22nd, after 2 days of deliberation, they found Mike guilty of Amy's murder. Since they could not reach a unanimous verdict about whether or not to give him the death penalty, Mike wound up receiving a sentence of life imprisonment with no possibility of parole for 35 years. The plan was to put Maurice Pierce, the alleged mastermind of the crime, on trial in April of 2003, but there was doubt about whether the state could present a solid case against him. Following his arrest, Maurice never admitted to the crime, and the confession he had made back in 1991 was ruled to be inadmissible as evidence. Since Rob and Mike had each admitted to the crime, their respective confessions could be introduced as evidence against the other at their respective trials, but Texas state law would not allow them to be used as evidence against Maurice, since he himself had never confessed. In addition, both Rob and Mike refused to testify as witnesses at Maurice's trial, meaning that the evidence against them was virtually non-existent. So in January of 2003, 3 months before his trial was scheduled to take place, the murder charges against Maurice were dropped, and he was released from jail, though the door was still open to charge him again if new evidence surfaced. In October of 2003, Michael Scott's best friend, Patrick Davidson, was indicted by a federal grand jury on the charges of being an accessory after the fact, failing to report a felony, making a false statement, and obstruction of justice. During his confession, Mike claimed that he had given Patrick a paper bag containing the .380 pistol used in the murders and told him to hide it. And after he confessed, Mike supposedly called Patrick and told him to tell the police about the gun if they asked. Patrick was questioned by investigators a few days later and said he recalled Mike giving him a paper bag back in 1991, so he threw it in a trash container at his apartment complex. However, Patrick apparently changed his story several times over the next few years, and by the time Mike went to trial, the official story which was presented was that the .380 had been tossed into Lake Austin right after the murders. By the time Patrick was indicted on these charges, he denied that Mike had ever given him a gun or a paper bag, but since he could have faced 20 years in federal prison and $1 million in fines, Patrick agreed to a plea deal in which he would plead guilty to the charges in exchange for only 1 year in federal prison. Many people suspected that Patrick was targeted by the authorities as retaliation for their inability to secure a conviction against Maurice Pierce. In March of 2005, the United States Supreme Court ruled that juveniles should not be executed for crimes they had committed while they were under the age of 18, and since Robert Springsteen had been 17 years old at the time the yogurt shop murders occurred, his death sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. While Rob's case would soon be heard in front of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and in May of 2006, they voted by a decision of 5-4 to overturn his conviction. In their eyes, the state's decision to use excerpts of Mike's confession at Rob's trial violated the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which states that, quote, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be confronted with the witnesses against him, end quote. Mike's case was also heard by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and in June of 2007, they voted to overturn his conviction on the same grounds. Since neither Rob or Mike had testified as witnesses at the other's trial, their respective defense attorneys never got the opportunity to cross-examine them and refute any incriminating statements they might have made during their confessions. Both defendants were eventually remanded to the Travis County Jail while the state decided whether or not to retry them, and on June the 24th, 2009, a Travis County judge ruled that Rob and Mike should both be released from jail on personal bond. The previous year, both men's defense teams had requested advanced DNA testing on various pieces of evidence from the crime scene, including vaginal swabs. The state agreed to the testing, believing that it might help provide them with additional evidence to use against the defendants when they went to trial again. Since much of the evidence was going to contain mixtures of male DNA and female DNA, an independent lab in Fairfax, Virginia, would specifically perform YSTR testing, aka short tandem repeat testing, specific to the male Y chromosome. A semen sample taken from Jennifer's body had actually matched the DNA of Sammy Buchanan, her boyfriend, at the time of the murders. It would turn out that earlier that same day, Jennifer had visited Sammy at his apartment and had consensual sex with him before she left to work her shift at the yogurt shop, so there was no reason to consider Sammy a suspect. However, traces of Sammy's DNA were also found on Sarah's body, which seemed to indicate that someone had raped Jennifer and then inadvertently transferred Sammy's DNA onto Sarah when he raped her. The testing also revealed a YSTR strand of male DNA on a vaginal swab taken from Amy, which confirmed that she had been raped as well, and the same individual's DNA was also found on Jennifer. But to the state's surprise, it turned out the DNA did not match Rob or Mike. It also did not match Maurice or Forrest either, and no DNA belonging to any of the four defendants could be found on the evidence or anywhere at the murder scene. The presence of this new DNA profile conclusively proved that at least one other unknown person had participated in the crime. It's also been reported that two other separate unidentified male DNA profiles were found on Sarah and the clothing which had been used to bind Eliza's wrists. Unfortunately, the DNA samples were so small that they could not be entered into any databases such as CODIS to see if they matched any known offenders. By this point, Rosemary Lemberg was the Travis County District Attorney handling the case, but even though this unknown male DNA did not match any of the four defendants, Lemberg did not believe this conclusively proved their innocence. Instead, she wondered if an unidentified fifth individual had participated in the crime alongside them and left his DNA behind, even though this extra perpetrator was never mentioned in any of the confessions. Lemberg also brought up the possibility of cross-contamination of the evidence, but the DNA would be tested against hundreds of people who may have frequented the yogurt shop, such as firefighters, police officers, evidence technicians, former employees of the shop, or friends and acquaintances of the victims, and no matches were made. But even though Lemberg still held the belief that Rob and Mike were both involved in the crime, she knew that the DNA findings would make it very difficult to take them to trial again, so on October the 28th, 2009, 10 years after the two men were originally arrested, it was announced that the murder charges against them had been dismissed, and they were released from their personal bond. Some of the jurors from Rob and Mike's original trials have since been re-interviewed, and at least 7 of them have stated that if the results from the DNA testing had been available to them at that time, they never would have found the defendants guilty. In the years following their release, Rob and Mike have continued to maintain their innocence, but even though they have filed petitions to seek compensation for their imprisonment, Texas courts have ruled that they are not entitled to it, since it has still not been conclusively proven that they did not commit the crime. Well, even though Maurice Pierce was never convicted of the murders, his arrest and 3 years of incarceration in jail made him very paranoid and distrustful of law enforcement. In 2008, Maurice would be arrested on 2 separate occasions for minor offenses and violently resisted arrest. On December the 23rd, 2010, Maurice Pierce was pulled over for a seemingly routine traffic stop by Austin police officers Frank Wilson and Bradley Smith after he failed to properly stop at a stop sign. While this was going on, Maurice was speaking to his daughter on his cell phone and said, quote, "They're after me again," before telling his daughter he loved her and would never see her again. Maurice then attempted to flee the scene on foot until Officer Frank Wilson caught up with him. A struggle ensued, in which Maurice removed a utility knife from Wilson's belt and stabbed him in the neck, so Wilson responded by pulling out his gun and fatally shooting Maurice. A toxicology report would show that Maurice had a blood alcohol level of 0.14 at the time of his death, which was over the legal limit. Wilson survived his injuries, and the shooting was ruled to be justified, as he claimed that he had no idea who Maurice was when he pulled him over. Sadly, Eliza's mother, Maria Thomas, passed away in March of 2015 at the age of 60, but in spite of the overturned convictions, she always publicly maintained her belief that Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott were guilty of her daughter's murder. However, in recent years, it seems like the brunt of the suspicion has been directed towards the 2 unidentified men that Tim Stryker and Margaret Sheehan saw in the yogurt shop prior to closing time, and it's believed that they might be the source of the unidentified male DNA. In 2017, an Austin police officer submitted the DNA sample from Amy's vaginal swab into a public academic YSDR database from the University of Central Florida's National Center for Forensic Science. It wound up matching a male DNA sample which had anonymously been submitted into the database by the FBI. The sample had no name attached to it, but may have belonged to a federally convicted offender, arrestee, or detainee. The FBI have declined to reveal the identity of this man in accordance with privacy laws involving anonymity for donors. Indeed, the DNA sample from the yogurt shop is not a complete profile, but rather just a YSDR profile which only had 16 markers and could potentially match thousands or even millions of individuals. By comparison, whenever genetic genealogy is used to help solve a cold case, it usually involves DNA profiles which have between 67 and 111 markers. In 2020, Texas Congressman Michael McCaul, an Austin native who once served as the state's deputy attorney general, became involved in the case and convinced the FBI to work with the Austin PD to see if further testing could be performed on the YSTR DNA sample, and this testing wound up producing 9 new markers, which brought the sample's total to 25. However, the problem is that one of these new markers did not match the FBI sample and the University of Central Florida's database, which has pretty much excluded the sample's donor from being the source of the DNA from the yogurt shop murders. However, even though this lead turned out to be a dead end, it compelled Congressman McCaul to co-sponsor a new bill which would allow the families of cold case victims the opportunity to petition the federal government to re-examine cases which were over 3 years old. The House Judiciary Committee passed legislation in December of 2021, and 8 months later, President Joe Biden officially signed the Homicide Victims Families Rights Act into law. However, even though the Austin Yogurt Shop murders has helped lead to positive change in cold case investigations, this new bill has still not brought this case any closer to a resolution. Ever since the convictions of Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott were overturned, no one else has ever been charged with the crime, and after nearly 32 years, there are still no conclusive answers about who was actually responsible for the Austin Yogurt Shop murders. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Until next week, at least. Yes, I'm sorry, folks. I'm now going to have to leave you on a cliffhanger as this brings an end to part one of our series about the Austin Yogurt Shop murders. But I shall return next Wednesday with part two, where I'll be sharing more details about the crime, as well as providing my own theories and analysis about what happened. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Melissa Lovell for narrating the opening of this episode. We've been carrying on this monthly listener voiceover contest for 6 years now, and if you've already entered, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives. This past month, I released a follow-up to a popular Patreon episode I did last year, where I discussed my top 10 favorite movies inspired by true crimes. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the 1985 disappearance of George Owens. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. And we now have over 50 of those commentary tracks in our archives for your listening. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Brenda P., Christine Q., Kenneth B., and The Moncrat. Thank you so much for your support. Anyway, in just over a month, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, so in order to do so, please visit crimecon.com and use the special promo code COLE23. That's COLE23. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, like I mentioned in the intro, this coming weekend, I'll be in Austin and appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, and I hope to see some of you folks there in person. But if not, have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for part two of our series about the Austin Yogurt Shop murders on The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.